this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Project Luxury. While the Triangle has seen a surge in upscale hotels, the region still can't support uber-elegant establishments such as the Ritz-Carlton. And that's on the front page. The story actually begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, A Ceiling on Upscale Hotels. More high-end properties now dot the Triangle map, but the luxury brands haven't followed. And this article is written by Amanda Hoyle. Before pharmaceutical executive Bill Humphreys moved to Raleigh in 2009, he was spending a lot of time in hotels. I would be stuck a lot of times at the Marriott or DoubleTree on Miami Boulevard in Durham, he recalls. The upscale chain hotels were convenient to his company's campus in Research Triangle Park, but those weren't where he wanted to put up his family when they visited from Atlanta. For them, he reserved a room at the five-star The Umstead Hotel and Spa in Cary, where his company had a corporate account. When we checked in and they found out it was me, my wife, and two kids, they immediately upgraded us to a suite and had a Wii game console delivered to the room before we even got there, Humphrey says. It was one of those, you had me at hello. As companies are loosening the purse strings again for business travel and talent recruitment, spending is up almost 5% to $300 billion. The Triangle's luxury and high-end hotels are booking more guests than they ever have before and charging higher rates. In the Triangle, two new full-service boutique hotels have opened in downtown Durham, with advertised guest rates starting at $200 and $260 per night, and penthouse suites at $860 and $1,000 per night. Boosters of downtown Raleigh are building a case to build at least 1,000 more hotel rooms in the downtown district to help support bigger convention and trade shows at the Raleigh Convention Center. Average room rates for high-end hotels in the region are up 20% from 5 years ago, which in turn has helped boost room occupancy tax receipts that help pay for the Raleigh Convention Center, PNC Arena, and other sports and culture-related projects. Occupancy has increased to nearly 72%, with 22 high-end hotel properties registered in Wake, Durham, and Orange counties as of June 2015, compared to occupancy of 65% and 20 properties in 2009, according to STR Incorporated. But higher occupancy levels remain half the story for the Triangle hotel industry. Numbers show business travelers are less willing to pay high room rates at area hotels, or at least hotel operators are afraid to test the market by charging higher rates when compared to other cities such as Charlotte, Miami, Austin, Texas, and Nashville, Tennessee. That resistance could eventually thwart any effort to land a Ritz-Carlton, W Hotel, or a Four Seasons in the coming years. For example, in Austin, the city has almost 8,500 top-tier hotel rooms that generate an average of $203 per night after corporate and group discounts. In the Triangle, there are about 4,800 rooms in the comparable category that demand an average of $150 per night in room rent. That scenario plays over and over when the local area is compared to many cities with a similar population base. And observers say that may have prevented Raleigh-Durham from entering the Uber luxury zone. By year-end 2015, the Triangle hotel market overall is forecast to see an increase of 4% in average revenue per room, also known as RevPAR, and a key indicator of a hotel property's performance and profitability, according to PKF Hospitality Research. That's a solid growth projection, says Scott Smith, managing director of PKF's Atlanta office, but it's still lower than a 7.2% RevPAR increase that's estimated nationally. The Triangle's average daily rate is projected to increase 3.5% by year-end 2015, primarily due to the number of new hotel rooms that are opening with higher-than-average nightly rates. We are not a Charlotte. Hotel activity in the Triangle still is driven primarily by business travel and corporate and university training events, mostly through companies in business-to-business industries. Because the Triangle lacks corporate headquarters in business-to-consumer industries, it doesn't attract the large groups of executives and sales personnel who visit their company's home turfs for meetings and events. On weekends, Triangle hoteliers often struggle to fill rooms, a scenario that often changes the profit margins for property investors. Jim Bailey, general manager at the Umstead Hotel, says his 150-room hotel usually hits around 98% occupancy during the week, mostly with business travelers. On the weekends, though, it's a different client altogether, he says. It's mostly local couples coming from a 30-mile radius to celebrate a special occasion. The independent-owned Umstead Hotel is more the exception than the rule for the high-end hotel industry in the Triangle that's still dominated by the national upscale chain brands affiliated with Marriott, Hilton, Sheraton, and Embassy Suites that can draw from a customer base of national accounts. The region has yet to attract the attention from a luxury boutique brand like a W Hotel, Four Seasons, or the Ritz-Carlton. We are not a Charlotte. We are not a Nashville, or a top 25 MSA market that typically has more demand from conventions, contends Mark Laporte, president and CEO of Concord Hospitality Enterprises Company, a Raleigh-based hotel development and management company that to date has more than $500 million in new hotel building projects underway from South Florida to New York City. In 2008, Concord Hospitality opened one of Raleigh's most popular high-end hotel properties, the Renaissance Hotel at North Hills. But today there is a lot more competition from other cities that are attracting investors seeking higher rates of return on their hotel investments. The Renaissance met its pro forma in its first year, even after opening at the worst time right after the Lehman Brothers collapse in 2009, and it's exceeded its goal every year since then. That was proof of concept that the market was ready for this, Laporte says. But while our rates have gone up 25% in the past 5 years, buildings in Miami are up 35%. Nashville is even higher. It costs just as much to build in Charlotte or in Nashville as it does here, so you go where the money is. In recent months, there have been several disruptions in the Triangle business travel market, most notably the $11 billion acquisition of Raleigh-based Salix Pharmaceuticals by Valeant Pharmaceuticals in April. After the deal was complete, Valeant dismissed nearly 260 employees of Salix's research and executive staff who had been based at its office park in North Raleigh, and with it, much of the corporate travel by Salix consultants and clients who would often room at the Renaissance Hotel when in Raleigh, doing business with the company. That had a huge impact on us when they pulled the plug on this market, and many of the other pharma corporate accounts are doing a little less travel in the Triangle these days, Laporte says. Demand for upscale amenities. Downtown Durham's newest boutique hotel, The Durham, for example, opened in July and is advertising nightly rates starting at between $259 and $279, plus a 1,050-square-foot penthouse suite that's charging $890 per night. Daniel Robinson, a Durham businessman and development partner in the Durham Hotel project, says the city has been well-served for many years by hotels like the upscale Washington Duke Inn, but the Washington Duke is often filled on key dates and caters more to guests affiliated with Duke University. Duke is not all Durham has to offer, Robinson says. Locally, the upscale hotel market has been underserved for decades. That's all about to change. The Durham, with its 54 guest rooms, is one of four new hotels, adding a cumulative 445 hotel rooms to the downtown Durham district in 2015, including the following: the 21C Museum Hotel, a boutique hotel, restaurant, and art museum concept that is owned and operated by a company based in Louisville, Kentucky, opened in March. A Residence Inn by Marriott opened in a redeveloped old hospital building near the Brightleaf District in July. The Aloft Durham Downtown Hotel is slated to open in September in a new building adjacent to the Durham Performing Arts Center. Both the 21C Museum Hotel and the Durham Hotel were built in former bank buildings that have outlived their original purpose. Both are also catering to Durham's creative class and business travelers coming into Research Triangle Park. The hotel operators say their research shows that type of traveler is searching for a more localized, personal, full-service experience than many perceive they can not get from a chain hotel. From the moment we first saw downtown Durham, we saw something special was going on, says Craig Greenberg, president of 21C Museum Hotels. That excitement was exacerbated when we saw the Hill Building. We enjoy doing historical rehabilitations. We think it creates a unique guest experience. The 21C Museum has its own curated art gallery that's open to the public, and the Counting House restaurant that's become a popular hotspot for after-hours events, dinners, and parties. The Durham will have its own full-service restaurant and rooftop bar that will be managed by one of the Triangle's top chefs, Andrea Rusing, a James Beard Award winner and owner of the highly acclaimed Lantern Restaurant in Chapel Hill. Robinson says his team was well aware of the competition opening around the same time as the Durham, but their early analysis of the market showed there would still be an underserved niche. We wanted to build high quality in a unique space, and we think we've achieved that, he says. The flip side is you can't afford to overspend because there is a glass ceiling on room rates in this market. We knew we wouldn't be able to afford to charge $600 to $700 a night like you can in some markets. In Raleigh, several hotel investors have been kicking around plans to build more full-service hotels in the downtown district or even near Crabtree Valley Mall. But in contrast, what's been happening in Durham, where developers were able to retrofit old office buildings, Raleigh has fewer vacant building options that would be amenable to hotel conversion. There is certainly room for a boutique hotel in downtown Raleigh, says Lauren Gold, executive vice president of the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau, noting that there's been several people who have looked at turning the Sir Walter Apartments back into a hotel, but there's a lot of obstacles still for that to happen. We need to put forth a more proactive strategy. Building on repeat business. For global business travelers like Ellen Rode, a retired VF Corporation executive who travels to Raleigh regularly for collaborations with NC State University's College of Textiles and Poole College of Management, it's an added plus that the Triangle's hotel industry is getting an upgrade. Even NC State Centennial Campus will be getting its own upscale hotel in 2016 when the 164-room Stateview Hotel and Conference Center, under an affiliation agreement with the upscale Marriott Autograph Collection, opens. For a while, I was usually staying at a Marriott or Hilton properties just based on knowledge of those brands and not really having access to other options, says Rode, who now splits her time between homes in Columbia, South Carolina, and Scottsdale, Arizona. My first impression of the Umstead was something like, this cannot really be in Raleigh, very much like boutique hotels in major U.S. cities in Europe, she says. As for Bill Humphreys, the pharmaceutical executive who's made his residence in Raleigh a little more permanent after convincing the top executives of MERS to move its U.S. headquarters from Greensboro to Raleigh in 2015, he's a little more selective about which hotels he chooses to recommend to visiting executives, trainees, and potential employee recruits. If they want to be closer into the city, it's the Renaissance Hotel or Hyatt House at North Hills in Raleigh. But if they are a potential recruit for MERS, it's most likely going to be the Umstead Hotel in Cary. I've stayed at the Four Seasons and other luxury hotels around the world, but nothing compares to the intimacy and authenticity as the Umstead, he says. But having just the Umstead or the 21C or the Durham Hotel is far from enough for a city competing with Boston, Austin, Nashville, Dallas, and Atlanta. For financiers and hotel developers, the equation in the Triangle has to change. As Concord's Laporte says, in recent years, Concord has focused Triangle expansion on its bread-and-butter projects, the less expensive select service and extended stay hotels, such as the Hyatt House at North Hills and the Residence Inn by Marriott that opened in Durham in August, rather than a luxury brand. and the company is investing more of its capital in other markets, such as a new hotel at South Beach in Miami, or a four-story hotel downtown Pittsburgh. LaPorte says the hotel in Pittsburgh is expected to have room rates starting around $220 per night, whereas that same hotel in Raleigh would start at around $190 per night. That extra $30 spend can be significant, he says. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. Smooth jazz tunes for a worthy cause. With little more than 150 people present at the Contemporary Art Museum in Raleigh on August 22, legendary saxophonist Branford Marsalis and pianist Joey Caldarazzo put on a show, playing at the request of his pals Terrence and Tori Holt, who run the Holt Brothers Foundation. Marsalis played for a little more than an hour in front of the intimate crowd to support the foundation's Kids Can program, which provides emotional support to children with a parent with cancer. Marsalis sits on the board of the foundation. Biz was told by the foundation folks that the charity raised more than $50,000 in one night. The local execs present at the soiree included Paragon Bank's Bob Hatley, Rex Hospital's Steve Burris and Lisa Schiller, Bank of America's Virginia Parker, CEPI Engineering founder CEPI Saidi, Dixon Hughes, Goodman's Randy Broad, Klein Design's Gary Klein, and several others. Anytime we are able to showcase the foundation's work to an influential group of people willing to help the cause by providing them with world-class artistry, it's a win-win night for everyone, Terrence Holt told Biz. Batting it out during budget extra innings. NC House Speaker Tim Moore, Republican Cleveland County, and Senate Leader Phil Berger, Republican Rockingham, recently met with local representatives of the American Legion. During the visit, Legion members presented Moore and Berger with baseball bats in honor of the American Legion World Series games, held annually in Shelby in August. After a few formal photos, the two lawmakers posed for a playful shot pretending to lock bats. Moore tweeted, and quickly after that, hashtag NC budget negotiations nearly came to blows. Pack-a-palooza packs them in on Hillsboro. Raleigh's Hillsboro Street was transformed into a mile-long party for 8 hours August 22 as NC State University welcomed its students back to campus. More than 350 vendors and a succession of live musical acts, including NCSU Chancellor Randy Woodson on guitar, participated in the street fair. Representatives of NCSU Athletics, including men's basketball coach Mark Gottfried, greeted students as well. According to NCSU, hashtag Packapalooza was the 12th highest trend on Twitter throughout the day in the Raleigh area, with 240 tweets per hour between 9 p.m. and 11 p.m. McCreary to CNN, lots to love about Raleigh. Garner native and country music star Scotty McCreary, recently shooting a video tour for CNN, shared with the network his favorite things about growing up around Raleigh. In the video, he mentions the Angus Barn, Pullen Park, and the North Carolina Sports Hall of Fame and Museum. Y'all might know me from country radio and American Idol, but really, in my heart, I'm a Carolina boy, McCreary tells CNN. And finally, in a section called The Hype, Triangle Cities make headlines in recent national rankings. Number 3, Durham Chapel Hill Metro is number 3 for reducing car commutes, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Number 5, Durham Chapel Hill is number 5 metro for black-owned businesses, according to NerdWallet. Number 5, Raleigh voted as the 5th best city for local food scene, USA Today Travel Readers. Number 12, Raleigh-Cary is 12th best metro for black-owned businesses, NerdWallet. Number 14, Durham is 14th best city for small business, Thumbtack. And number 23, Raleigh is 23rd best city for small business, according to Thumbtack. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, New Investors Take Over the Factory Retail and Sports Complex in Wake Forest. Raleigh real estate developer Jeff Ammons has sold his ownership in The Factory, the sprawling 36-acre sports and entertainment complex that he spent the past 12 years building out from an old street sweeper manufacturing plant building on Main Street in Wake Forest. The new ownership, the Mac Sidney Company, is a collaboration among a group of investors from New York and Oregon. Representatives were not available for comment, but investment advisor Matthew Greenspan of Marcus and Millchap, who consulted with the group on the buy, says they plan to keep the same property management staff on site, including event and property manager Emma Bennett. Ammons bought the 200,000-square-foot building in 2003 for $4 million, and within 1 year he reopened the building as one of the largest indoor and outdoor entertainment complexes in the region. The building has two ice rinks, an indoor soccer facility, a YMCA fitness gym, and classes for martial arts, gymnastics, and other youth sports. The property also has six baseball and softball fields in use by North Wake Baseball Association, plus buildings and spaces for several restaurants and retailers, including Village Deli and Gonza Tacos and Tequila. They are wanting to keep everything the same and bring in more family-oriented tenants to the property, Greenspan says. They think Jeff has done a phenomenal job and want to build on the synergies already there. Ammons sold his whole ownership in the factory for $17.85 million, according to county records, and will no longer be a part of the project. But I've got a hockey player and a figure skater in the family who practice there, so we'll still be there a lot, Ammons says. Local impact of the big Belk buyout. Following the August 24 announcement that Charlotte-based Belk Incorporated will be acquired by a New York private equity firm for nearly $3 billion, TBJ researched the department store's investments in the Triangle. Belk executives say that the Belk name is going to stay and that there are no immediate plans to close any stores or lay off any employees. In the Triangle, Belk has 10 store locations, some of which it owns and some of which it leases. Here's the breakdown. At Crabtree Valley Mall in Raleigh, which has one of Belk's largest flagship stores in the company, the anchor leases about 305,000 square feet from the mall ownership. At the streets at South Point Mall in South Durham, Belk owns its 179,770 square foot anchor space that's worth $10.6 million in tax value. At Triangle Town Center Mall in North Raleigh, Belk owns its 178,616 square foot department store anchor space that's worth $16.5 million in tax value. At Cary Town Center Mall in Cary, Hudson Belk Company owns its 168,192 square foot department store space that's worth $5.4 million in tax value. Belk owns its 21,060 square foot store space at the Triangle East Shopping Center in Zebulon, a space that has a tax value of $1.6 million. It leases its store space at the North South Station Shopping Center at 1451 Garner Station Boulevard in South Raleigh, where it has been a tenant since 1995. And Belk also operates smaller format stores in Smithfield, Henderson, Dunn, Sanford, and Southern Pines. And in a section called On the Horizon, home builder unveils plan for new neighborhood near Mordecai Oakwood. The new owners of the now demolished Brookview rental housing community at the edge of Raleigh's downtown district proposed their new plan to neighbors August 24 that will include construction of up to 58 new single-family homes between the historic Mordecai and Oakwood neighborhoods. The new community, to be called Oakdale at Mordecai, will have homes priced from the 500,000s, with the first units expected to break ground soon and scheduled completion in early 2016. Roebuck Homes of Raleigh will be the builder. Walmart looking to bring second grocery store to Raleigh. South Carolina-based developer WRS Incorporated has presented plans in Raleigh to build a new retail center at the corner of Poole and New Hope Roads that would include a 43,000-square-foot grocery store for a Walmart neighborhood market. WRS is also the developer seeking to build a grocery store space for Walmart at the corner of Buffalo and New Hope Roads in Raleigh. And now we turn to the On Pharma page in the Triangle Business Journal, written by Jason DeBruin. The first headline, Novo Nordisk to invest $1.2 billion in JOCO. Diabetes drug manufacturer Novo Nordisk will build a $1.2 billion manufacturing facility in Johnston County and add 691 jobs there in the coming 5 years. The global healthcare company has nearly a century of experience in diabetes care and has also branched out into hemophilia care, growth hormone therapy, and hormone therapy. Based in Copenhagen, Denmark, the company already has a Triangle presence. The company employs 39,000 workers in 75 countries. The new jobs announcement comes with a $15.9 million job development investment grant, a grant made by the state to encourage economic development. The average wage of the workers will be $68,420, almost double the average annual wage in Johnston County. Economic developers touted the announcement and the new jobs are welcomed, especially since the Triangle's pharmaceutical industry has seen more layoffs than hires recently. The first big hit came last year when GlaxoSmithKline announced more than one round of layoffs, followed by Salix Pharmaceuticals, Parexel International Corporation, Hospira, and most recently when Biogen took over Eisai's RTP facility. For the first half of 2015, Novo Nordisk recorded nearly $8 billion in net sales and $4 billion of operating profit. Sales were up 25% compared with the same time last year. Operating profit was up 57% compared with the first 6 months of last year. Narrow provider networks offer cost savings. In the new health insurance marketplaces, insurers have limited options for offering plans at different price points within a metal tier. ACA-mandated changes, such as community rating, standardized benefits, and removing limits on annual or lifetime benefits, mean that insurers must find other strategies for offering lower-cost plans. Narrow provider networks have emerged as one of the only remaining pieces in the insurer's cost containment toolbox. Researchers from the University of Pennsylvania analyzed the prevalence of narrow networks in every state, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation published their findings. North Carolina has a rate of 13% of narrow networks in the state. And finally, we have a question and answer titled, CEO Cindy Whitehead reflects on Sprout's $1 billion Valeant deal. Canada-based Valeant Pharmaceuticals International Incorporated will buy Raleigh-based Sprout Pharmaceuticals for $1 billion in cash. The deal came just 2 days after Sprout, headquartered in North Hills, received FDA approval to begin selling Adderall, the first-ever treatment to boost libido. Adderall is approved to treat generalized hypoactive sexual desire disorder, HSDD, in premenopausal women. What was the best part of the week? That moment of the FDA approval was just overwhelming for the company. We are a company of 34 people and everyone gave their heart and soul to get to the finish line. What was the most stressful part of the week? Between 5 and 7 p.m. the day of the announcement. How did the company celebrate? We had been pacing, but in that moment right after we heard, I was at a loss for words. Emails started pouring in. Pictures started coming in. There were so many people counting on us, and their reactions were amazing. The FDA approval also came with some pretty serious warnings. Was your enthusiasm tempered at all by that? This has always been about getting this right for women. We actually recommended it be approved with the risk evaluation and mitigation strategy. a requirement that doctors go through an educational slide deck before they may prescribe the drug. We know how much anticipation there is for this product, so we wanted to make sure it goes out the right way. This drug had been rejected twice by FDA. Was there ever a moment when you were afraid that you wouldn't be successful? This has been a very hard process. Of course, there were moments that were really tough moments, but what I always turn to is why we were doing this in the first place. I can go to our general email box and be reminded of why we were doing this. Women were writing us every week, thanking us for letting them know that they are not alone in suffering from HSDD. What is the marketing strategy? We won't immediately advertise on TV, but instead try to educate doctors on ADE. One of the reasons that Valiant is a great partner is that they have kept the team and they kept the plan. And now we turn to the On Technology page written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, Close Calls with Drones, Up in U.S., RDU Not Immune. It's becoming a more common, albeit alarming, anecdote across the country. 15 miles north of Raleigh-Durham International Airport, a pilot flying a commercial airliner from Philadelphia reported a close call with an unmanned aircraft. Federal Aviation Administration spokeswoman Kathleen Bergen confirms that the crew of Shuttle America 3313 reported spotting a drone August 9 at an altitude of 8,000 feet. The pilot took no evasive action, and the flight landed safely at 7:30 p.m. at RDU. The FAA is investigating. Bergen says local numbers aren't available and that there's no way to know how common the incident is in the Triangle, but across the country, new FAA reports show unmanned aircraft have seen a dramatic increase over the past year, from 238 sightings in all of 2014 to more than 650 by August 9 of this year. In June 2014, 16 unmanned aircraft were reported by pilots. In June of this year, 138 reports were filed. Currently, only organizations with a specific FAA exemption can legally fly drones for commercial or research purposes, but photographers and farmers have confirmed they're flying anyway in multiple statements to Triangle Business Journal. And hobbyists can legally fly as long as they meet certain restrictions, such as maintaining sight lines and flying at or below 400 feet. Some in the profession fear that pilots ignoring FAA guidelines could ruin the technology for everyone. That's why the FAA has teamed up with several technology players, including Raleigh-based drone developer Precision Hawk, on a project dubbed Pathfinder. The company is currently testing what's called LATAS, L-A-T-A-S, Low Altitude Tracking and Avoidance Systems, as a way to manage drones. The project involves testing operations beyond visual line of sight in what execs have described as low-risk, non-populated areas, such as farmland. CEO Bob Young uses the term geofencing to describe how the GPS-driven technology works. It literally stops them from flying into areas they are not allowed to fly into, he explains. It's that ability to keep the drones away from areas they shouldn't go, whether or not the pilot of the drone makes the mistake or not. It's a 3-year project, though Precision Hawk expects its portion of the research to be completed early in that time frame, but he says he can't speak for the FAA. They are under a lot of political pressure to announce solutions as quickly as they can, so we are working very hard, he says. And in a section called They Said It, first from Merritt Moore, Managing Director for Lookout Capital. I just need to know what it does and why would anyone care or why would a customer pay for it? And from Jason Kaplan, co-founder of Bull City Venture Partners. I think starting valuation discussions in a deck for the first meeting is something I'd recommend dropping. And in a startup update, Ellie Brown, one of the Smithfield sisters behind sticker startup Evreware, spelled E-V, capital R, capital E, W-A-R-E, Sticky Ties, offers some advice for anyone trying out for Shark Tank. Brown's company accepted serial entrepreneur Mark Cuban's offer to buy their company for $200,000 on air, but the deal fizzled when cameras went off and internet criticism ensued. Just be prepared for the backlash that you are willingly putting yourself in a vulnerable position, so just be prepared for what people are going to say to you and about you, Brown says. And now we turn to the On Transportation page in the Triangle Business Journal, and this is written by Jeff Jeffrey. The main headline, traffic deaths up in North Carolina. Fatal traffic crashes are up 19% across North Carolina so far this year, according to a report from the National Safety Council, and the Triangle may be on pace to see at least as many traffic deaths as last year. Statewide, 634 people were killed in traffic collisions through June of this year, up from the 531 deaths North Carolina saw during the same period in 2014. The uptick in North Carolina tracks with the national trend. Traffic deaths across the country are up 12% in 2015, going from 16,400 last year to 18,630 this year. The increase follows 2 years of declining traffic fatalities and puts the country on pace for its deadliest driving year since 2007, according to the NSC report. The NSC says the increase in traffic deaths may be a result of an improving economy and low gas prices, which have resulted in an increase in the number of vehicle miles traveled. It's more difficult to determine where the Triangle stands at this point in the year. The NSC report did not provide a more granular breakdown of where fatal crashes occurred within each state, but a review of data from the North Carolina Department of Transportation shows that 111 people died in traffic accidents within the Triangle as of June 30. The total number of traffic deaths in the region last year was 241. Some troubling trends are already emerging in several Triangle counties. In Lee County, for example, the number of fatal crashes as of June 30 was already double the number reported in the county for all of 2014. 16 people have been killed in motor vehicle crashes in Lee County this year, compared to 8 last year. Franklin County has already seen 4 people killed, the same number as last year. In Wake County, the Triangle's largest county, NCDOT reports 32 deaths for the first 6 months of 2015, meaning the county is already halfway to the 63 deaths it saw in 2014. That said, some other Triangle counties appear to be seeing a drop-off in fatal traffic crashes. Orange County saw just 2 traffic deaths during the first 6 months of this year. The county saw 10 during 2014. Durham County also appears to be seeing a decrease. 11 people were killed in the county as of June. That compares to the 27 deaths it saw last year. NCDOT has set a goal of cutting the number of traffic deaths in half by 2030. With lawsuits dropped, Bonner Bridge replacement can proceed. Construction of a replacement for the Herbert C. Bonner Bridge in Dare County will finally be allowed to proceed after years of litigation kept the project in limbo. Environmental groups represented by the Southern Environmental Law Center have dropped lawsuits against the North Carolina Department of Transportation, which sought to block construction of a replacement bridge parallel to the Bonner Bridge. The lawsuits were withdrawn under the terms of a June settlement agreement between NCDOT and the Defenders of Wildlife and the National Wildlife Refuge Association. The bridge carries NC-12 over the Oregon Inlet and provides the only highway connection between Hatteras Island and mainland North Carolina. The 52-year-old Bonner Bridge is in frequent need of repairs. Under the terms of the settlement, NCDOT was allowed to build a new parallel bridge alongside the Bonner Bridge, but NCDOT agreed to cease work on a separate 2.4-mile bridge within the southern half of Pea Island National Wildlife Refuge and into Pamlico Sound. NCDOT also agreed to study ways to move portions of NC-12 out of the wildlife refuge. Having the conservation groups formally drop the lawsuits removes the final roadblock keeping NCDOT from moving ahead with the replacement effort. NCDOT spokeswoman Jennifer Heiss says about 20% of the design work on the 3.5-mile-long replacement bridge needs to be finished before crews can break ground. Construction is expected to begin in the spring. A $216 million contract awarded to PCL Constructors Incorporated and HDR Engineering Incorporated of the Carolinas in 2011 remains in effect. NCDOT is also moving to build an interim bridge on P Island at the location of the existing temporary bridge that was constructed after Hurricane Irene formed a breach in 2011. Heiss says the $28 million interim bridge will be easier to maintain than the existing temporary bridge and will serve as a stopgap measure while NCDOT studies options for a long-term solution. Heiss says NCDOT expects to begin construction on that project as early as the end of this year. And finally, in the section He Said It, the quote, "The hard landing has created a panic to get these projects done." And that's from Stu Miller, co-founder and president of Yes Solar Solutions in Cary, which is working to convince Duke Energy to back a 2-year extension to North Carolina's renewable energy tax credit. So far, Duke remains neutral on whether the tax credit should be extended. And in manufacturing news in the Triangle Business Journal, Durham's Spoon Flour snags $25 million funding. This article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. Spoon Flour co-founder Stephen Fraser says a $25 million equity infusion means 50 new jobs in Durham. It also means even more validation for a 150-employee company that, when it began in 2008, seemed like a gamble. "Neither of us were wealthy people," he says of himself and co-founder Gart Davis, who is already in Germany preparing to open a Berlin operation. Nonetheless, they funneled $35,000 into the first incarnation of their website. "We were trying to get to a point where we could kind of test and see if this was something people were really interested in," he says. In those days, the website was invitation only. Design files would be outsourced to a printer in Cary, and Fraser would drive over and pick up the fabric printouts. After his kids had gone to bed, he and his wife would spend hours cutting the fabric and stuffing it in envelopes. Eventually, enough orders poured in, and the entrepreneurs took out a bank loan. They invested about $40,000 into a printer and moved the operation into a small stock room in Mebane. It seemed like an unbelievable amount of risk," he admits. "It was 1 year before the founders even collected a paycheck, relying on credit cards and home equity lines to survive. Today, the company is at more than 35,000 square feet of space in Durham. Eventually, they'll need an entirely new building all to themselves," Davis says. "The company is about to expand into another office suite in its current building and is bringing in more printers and more cutting tables according to its Inc. 5000 profile. The firm had a 2014 revenue of $15.3 million. It's looking for a chief financial officer and a chief marketing officer, and it's targeting growth, the kind of opportunity that makes investors travel all the way from Boston to get a piece of the potential. The Boston investors. Northbridge Growth Equity, which counts Acquia, Proto Labs, Clarity Software Systems, and SmartPak in its portfolio, made its first North Carolina investment in Spoon Flour. It wasn't Northridge principal Holly Maloney's first time in the Triangle. She's visited a number of ventures, but hadn't yet met what she was looking for, on-demand manufacturing and commerce, sensing significant tailwinds in the mass customization space. "Once we heard about Spoon Flour and what they were doing, it seemed like a highly differentiated service," she says. Russ Pyle, a partner at Northridge, who is joining the board with Maloney, says another investment in North Carolina is a definite possibility. "Conversations with other high-growth firms in the Triangle are ongoing, and Northridge will have representation at the upcoming CED Tech Venture Conference, the same event where it made the Spoon Flour connection in the first place. The firm typically invests in high-growth companies with revenues in the tens of millions," Maloney says. While a specific equity breakdown for the deal was not given, Maloney did confirm it was a minority investment and that the founding team is instrumental in the company's success going forward. The firm was joined by Durham-based Bull City Venture Partners in the round. Bull City has actively invested in its home region since its founding, as did Southern Capital Ventures. The firm BCVP co-founders Jason Kaplan and David Jones founded years ago. Bull City's current portfolio includes AdWorks, Reveal Mobile, Connect, and Full Measure Education. And now we turn to the small business section of the Triangle Business Journal to read the family business column written by James Lee, who is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill and a family business speaker, author, and advisor. The headline on his column, Valuable Qualities We Can Inherit from Our Children. I saw that tired old bumper sticker again the other day. Insanity is hereditary. We inherit it from our children. In fact, I have a number of friends who exhibit some symptoms, but they were a little wacky before they became parents. Even so, the sticker brought to mind a few things that we really do inherit from our kids. Legacies that flow upward from people who are younger and oftentimes shorter than we are, but who can, if we let them, profoundly influence how we adults see our world, run our businesses, and live our lives. I know a man who used to suffer from Polonius syndrome. It's a little discussed but widely manifested form of adult hypocrisy named after the character in Shakespeare's play Hamlet, Prince of Denmark. Polonius, you might recall, preaches to his son Laertes about being true to oneself, not spending too much on clothes, and otherwise behaving honorably. Then the insidious old coot hides behind a curtain to eavesdrop on Hamlet. The prince, no doubt acting out the fantasies of millions of the world's teenagers before and since, runs a sword through the curtain and turns Polonius into a Danish kebab. You can't imagine what my friend, the father of three daughters, did to manifest the Polonius syndrome. But what he inherited from his children as a result was a new and abiding respect for the basic rights of people over whom you exercise a degree of authority, plus a nifty Kevlar vest. What else do we inherit from our kids? How about the capacity to be a little less compulsive? To pause every now and then and ask, hey, what would actually happen if I didn't return every phone call immediately, didn't wear socks to work, didn't get to the office by 7 a.m. sharp 6 mornings a week? I know some very successful people who have inherited anti-compulsiveness, and they're grateful to have it. What else do we inherit from our kids? For many of us, it's 20 really nice designer neckties dispersed at the rate of 2 each Christmas for the next 10 years. Just because the old man's over the hill, my kids used to say, doesn't mean he has to dress like it. Thanks, kids. We inherit a heart-stoppingly bold, for people over 40 anyway, willingness to not plan everything. I preach planning as absolutely essential for effective family business management and ownership continuity, but even planning needs an occasional day off. It's okay every now and then to just see what happens, improvise, go with the flow, and once or twice a year, take the ultimate risk of flying standby. We inherit a bit of brightness, a freshness, and optimism that helps to balance our so-called wisdom of age, a wisdom that too often hardens into skepticism and unmitigated, unrelieved stodginess. We hear ourselves saying, bad idea, it'll never work, catastrophe coming, ruin the company. With our inheritance, we can learn to say, sure, why not, and mean it. We inherit a willingness, even an eagerness, to innovate. It's easy for those of us in the senior ranks to lose sight of the fact that the way we've always done things isn't always the way things ought to be done. The rate of change in today's business world is mind-boggling. Young people can show us how to keep up with change, even get ahead of it. We inherit increased comfort with a technologically challenging world. We have to actively pursue that comfort, of course. We have to hang out with our tech-savvy kids, ask questions, read, give the young people permission to put technology into the business, and practice using it. We inherit the ability to balance very hard and productive work with enjoyment of the benefits that work earns. Personal satisfaction, high-quality family time, material comfort, and confidence in the future. Our children can pass along relief from the worn-out, nose-to-the-grindstone mindset that has brought us business success at the expense of human success. So, insanity isn't the only thing we can inherit from our children. There is much of value that they can pass along to us, ideas, and attitudes that can enrich our business and personal lives. We have to accept the inheritance, of course, put it to good use, and be grateful for it. What we don't have to do is pay inheritance tax. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, who is the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Wall Street Volatility, Bad News for Startups. On August 24, minutes after the 9:30 a.m. opening, when the Dow Jones Industrial Average plummeted 1,000 points, one could almost hear the collective gasp across the newsroom. Something bad was happening, and happening fast. Fueled by news on China's economy, global trade slowdown, and the impending action of the Federal Reserve, Wall Street became irrational. Of course, that's not news. Correction of the stock market is an inevitability. It may have been a little late in coming this time around, but the frothy price-earnings ratio, coupled with two quarters of dismal revenue growth, although earnings were solid, a massive adjustment of equities and policies had to happen. In the end, most public companies that are experiencing this roller coaster ride of their stock prices probably would be okay. But what will be of bigger concern for the Triangle and North Carolina economy are the effects on mid-sized and small businesses. Thanks to a robust stock market, mergers and acquisitions have been flying off the shelves across all industries in the past couple of years. The first 6 months of 2015 saw $2.27 trillion in deals consummated across the globe, the second highest on record after the first half of 2007. $2.59 trillion, according to Ernst & Young, M&A was up some 37% year over year. This red-hot exit pipeline helped private equity firms, venture capitalists, entrepreneurs, cash flow positive technology and service firms, and even startups. So understandably, people did not waste time with finding and closing deals. The more deals you finished, the more money you made. The only downside? Workers. Layoffs happened. Companies did more with less to increase valuations, and that resulted in anemic job growth. But we knew there was money available to do deals. Say goodbye to those days, at least for now. Wall Street's actions in the past few days certainly is going to force many financiers to hit the pause button. And that is the worst news for startups. Initial funding rounds likely will get harder because VCs will increase their scrutiny and, by extension, ask for bigger chunks of the company. For companies burning through cash and getting ready for a new funder, the timing of this uber volatility could not be worse. But like anything, this too shall pass, and we will be back on our way talking about billion-dollar startups and $10 billion transactions of companies with no revenue. And about the ups and downs of the stock market, the question is never if, but when it comes to days such as August 24 or August 26, 2015. And now we turn to the Executive Voice column in the Triangle Business Journal that features Lister Delgado. The headline, Startup Trifecta, Money, Talent, Ideas, Insights from Idea Fund Partners Exits Expert. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. Lister Delgado, managing partner at Durham-based Idea Fund Partners, has evaluated more than 1,000 companies and advised more than 50 startups across the Southeast and Mid-Atlantic. To say he's entrenched in the local entrepreneurship culture is an understatement. While he's helped to funnel investments into a wide array of ventures, including Pack Purchase, Wedpix, and Pendo, Delgado is more than a cash coffer. Technical prowess gained through his experiences at AT&T, Bell Labs, and Lucent Technologies helps him take startups to the next level. Not every venture is successful. Take Argyle Social, which folded last year. But the exits, such as that of Automated Insights, an artificial intelligence platform that counts the Associated Press as a client, help push ahead not just his portfolio, but the Triangle entrepreneurship community. What was your first job? From ages 16 to 19, I had several manual labor jobs. The first one was cleaning carpets in Miami. I was a recent immigrant, and the job helped the family pay the bills. What did you want to be when you grew up? When I was very young, like many other kids in Peru, I probably wanted to be a professional soccer player or a firefighter. But the profession I truly remember wanting was engineering. I loved tinkering and solving problems. What got you involved in entrepreneurship? Engineering is a very entrepreneurial profession in Peru, where I grew up. I worked as an engineer for 5 years and then decided to get an MBA to learn about businesses. That is what allowed me to make the transition. What was your biggest professional blunder and how did you overcome it? Luckily, I don't think I've had a very big professional blunder, but I think I have made many small mistakes. The thing that sticks in my mind, however, is early on in my investing career, investing too much too early into a particular portfolio company. I did not overcome it then. Today, I invest differently. I write smaller checks, but more of them. I also pay more attention to signals of risk. What was your biggest professional victory? I have had several nice wins. One that I am proud of is investing in Robbie Allen very early on and helping fund Automated Insights, previously Statsheet, until its exit. Where do you see Triangle Entrepreneurship 10 years from now? Over the last 10 years, the Triangle has matured a lot as an entrepreneurial community. I think the next 10 years should see more growth. I think maturity was needed before the growth could come. For many years, we have had experienced lawyers, accountants, investors, the people that support entrepreneurs. What we are starting to have now is a growing number of successful repeat entrepreneurs. I think our growth will be driven by the number of successful repeat entrepreneurs that emerge from this region. What's the Triangle's biggest challenge when it comes to entrepreneurship and how do we overcome it? The problem is that there is not one thing that is holding us back. It is a chicken and egg problem of money, talent, and ideas. As I said above, if we can figure out a way to produce more successful repeat entrepreneurs, we will have solved the problem. Why should a startup stay in the Triangle? Because there is plenty of world-class talent here that is more affordable than in most other good entrepreneurial ecosystems. Also, good Triangle companies can more easily than ever get funding from funds based anywhere in the country. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.